Well, we had a marathon session over the weekend, my wife Renee and I, and working on our taxes. And we finished the job and actually electronically filed on Sunday evening. It was a good feeling. You may be in that situation too, or maybe you're not. And if you're not, or maybe you're even thinking about this year's taxes in 2012, not the 2011 taxes, better stay tuned. Scott Franklin's our guest. He's a certified public accountant, also holds a law degree, third generation CPA, second generation lawyer, lifelong resident of Milwaukee. He joined Kohler and Franklin, certified public accountants, in 1995. And he concentrates in the firm's tax and estate planning, business advisory, and litigation support practices. So very experienced, a writer and teacher on both accounting and legal topics. And he joins us today from our Milwaukee studios. Scott, are you there? Are you there, Scott? I'm hearing something, but I'm not. Well, tell you what, we'll see if he's. I know he's there. I can hear him in the background, but he may not be hearing me. That could be the problem. But we'll get to him in just a minute. Just stay with us here. Just thinking about taxes, and you know, my wife and I will not have to get an extension this year. Scott, I'm pretty sure, has some information on how to get an extension, or what are reasons to get one. I guess it's easy enough to go ahead and apply for one, but what are good reasons to get an extension? And I wonder if there's some bad reasons to get one, and what you really need to file for one, and how long can you get an extension? I have no idea. I've never done it. Have you? I never done it myself. And I am interested, frankly, in the reasons that you'd have to give. So, tell you what, I bet Scott Franklin can help us out, and I think we got him now. Let's see here. Let me see here. Scott, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Cool.
Well, technical trouble here at your Milwaukee studio.
Yeah, that's too bad. I could hear some talking in the background from the studio, but apparently you must not have been able to hear me.
Yeah, that's what the problem was.
Okay. Well, tell you what, we have plenty of people online already to talk to you with questions, but I did want to, you know, we're within a month of tax day. I'm sure most of us plan to get our returns done by the deadline, but I've just a couple of questions about extensions. Are there good reasons to get an extension, or what are the good reasons?
Well, just about any valid, legitimate need is good enough for an extension. On the federal tax return, you have to submit a form, and it's called a Form 4868. It's an automatic extension form. And you basically need to know what your name, address, and social security numbers are, and a guesstimate of what you think you're going to owe in taxes. Wisconsin does not have a separate extension form, and they pretty much are on the honor system. If you say you got a federal extension, Wisconsin accepts that at face value, and if there's a problem, Wisconsin would figure it out someday. Reasons for an extension could be you don't have all the information you know you need for a tax return. If you have partnership or trust in, issues on your tax return that you're waiting for, schedules K-1 that notoriously don't come out in time. If you have out-of-town travel where you can't get your returns done, if there's, you know, debts in the family or serious issues, just about any legitimate reason, as long as you're able to get the extension postmarked or electronically filed by April 17th, is good enough for an extension. The extension will buy the taxpayer 6 months from April 15th or April 17th until October 15th this year to get the tax return submitted. The extension does not resolve the income tax liability that is still due April 17th. So
if you take make a guess and put a check in the mail along with the extension letter.
Exactly. And the money is posted as of April 15th. If it turns out in September you finally finish your tax return and you don't owe any additional money, there's no penalty. If you owe money, at least you paid in something, but they do charge interest going back to April 17th. Then the question is, well, why do an extension instead of just filing your return late? And there are significant penalties for late filing a tax return without an extension.
Yeah.
And so
don't want to do that.
No, the 5 minutes it takes to submit a paper extension request or to do it electronically is definitely worth it.
All right. Well, Matilda in Baldwin has a question for you, so let's go to Matilda. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, and good morning, Scott. I have a question about a loss in my income. I have stock from a bank that is in an S corporation, and my share of the income is a loss of $120,000. So my total income is a loss of 90-some thousand. Now, my question is, can I defer some of this loss to another year?
Yes.
And I can.
It depends on what we call having adequate basis in the stock. And what the government looks at is, if you have losses being generated from an investment, have you invested enough money into that enterprise so that if you lose money, you can say you've lost money that you've invested, and you get a deduction up to the extent you have basis in a holding. And any losses over and above that would be carried over to future tax years to offset income from that venture or other related income. We also would see this typically with rental properties where you generate rental losses, and those losses also get carried over. The challenge is being able to document, if you are taking a loss, what your loss is for this year, and then just keeping track of the loss carry forward into the future.
Is there a form for that?
It would all be factored in on the various forms related to the Schedule K-1 that you're getting. The Schedule E of the personal tax return is going to show the deductible loss. Loss carryovers may appear on a Form 6198, which is one type of loss carryover for at-risk losses, and there are some other loss carryover forms as well, depending on what is generating the negative income according to the K-1 you received.
All right.
Now, my next question is, do I need to pay an estimated tax this year? I won't have any tax this year.
Well, estimated tax liabilities are based on looking at what your current year's taxes, and for most taxpayers who file a tax return, if you have zero taxable income and a zero tax liability, you are not required to pay estimates. Estimates would be required if your projected federal tax is going to be more than $1,000, or your Wisconsin tax, I believe, is more than $500, and you don't have at least 90% of that withheld during the year. So if you have absolutely no income, there is no requirement for estimated taxes.
All right. There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Matilda. And Linda in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for the question, both of you. For the first time, I filled out a Making Work Pay credit back in 2010, and I don't see it this year in 2011, and I'm curious when that started. Like, did it start in 29, and can you go back if it's not present? You know, I mean, can you go back and redo it in 29? But is there a Schedule M Making Work Pay credit for 2011? That's the main question I have, and if not, how come?
That did expire with the 2010 tax return. I believe it was a two-year program only for the 2009 and 2010 federal returns. If you believe you missed it on the 2009 return, you are able to go back and amend your federal tax return for up to 3 years from the date you filed it, or April of 2010, with the due date of that return. So you would be able to go back and get that money from 2009 if you missed it. But it is not available for 2011.
Could you tell me real quickly how you, what form you would do, or how you amend something like that?
Sure. To amend any federal tax return, you want to use a form 1040X, and that's available on the IRS website, irs.gov. The basic steps are you sit down with a copy of the return you previously filed, you redo the tax return the correct way, based on the new information you want, all the schedules and attachments that have a change also would need to be updated. And then the 1040X form is basically where you show three columns: what we've reported, the changes to what we reported, and what we should have reported. So that third column is where you will tabulate whether or not you overpaid or underpaid tax in the earlier year. And you send the 1040X and all of the corrected forms to the IRS. The IRS will process it, and if you owe money, they'll happily take your extra payment. If you have money coming back, they will refund it with interest.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's go to Bernie in Elkhorn next. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, good morning, and thanks in advance for your help. I've got two investment reporting questions for you. The first is, I own shares of GLD and SLV, the ETF, and I got a form 1099B that shows entries where there are times each month when the trust would sell off its assets. And I know that I need to put them in box column E of form 8949. My question is, where can I write off the corresponding investment expenses? Is it something that I need to keep track of this and do it when I sell the assets, or can I put them on 8949 in column G?
Well, typically investment expenses, at least in my eyes, are we talking about like brokerage fees, advisory fees, those type of investment expenses are generally going to be claimed as a deduction on Schedule A as a miscellaneous itemized deduction subject to 2% of your income. In some instances, you might have investment interest expense. Investment interest expense is going to be deducted on a form. The form number escapes me right now. It is a subsidiary form to the Schedule A. And investment interest expense is limited to the amount of investment income you had. So if you are deducting, if you are reporting $100 of interest income on your tax return and you have $200 of investment interest expense, you would be able to deduct $100 of that, and then the other $100 is carried into future tax years. And the investment interest expense form is a 4952. So that is where most of the investment-related expenses get deducted on tax returns.
Okay, thank you. One other question for you. I've got shares of U.S. Oil, and I got my wife and I have that both in IRAs and non-IRA, and I'm clear what to do on the non-IRA, but on I'm getting some Schedule K-1s with dollars in box 11C, basically capital gains or losses during the year. that are for the IRA, and I'm wondering, does that need to be reported?
No. The investments within the IRA are generating income that does not get reported from year to year. The only income on an IRA is when you take the distribution down the road. However, even though the registration of your ownership says IRA, the computer that spits out these K-1s doesn't know that.
Okay.
And so that's why it's being generated by the investment.
Would I need to file something just kind of a perfunctory way or nothing at all?
Nothing at all.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You're all right. Welcome. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Franklin, our guest today, certified public accountant. He works in the firm of Kohler & Franklin, certified public accountants out of Milwaukee. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network. I have a special invitation for you. As a matter of fact, on Thursday, April 5th, I will be hosting the second annual WPR Listener Dinner, and it's going to be at Milwaukee's Mitchell Park Domes. I'll be doing a mock garden talk show with Milwaukee gardening guru Melinda Myers. Great chance to meet Melinda, myself, Kathleen Dunn, and Ben Marins are going to be there. WPR Milwaukee Bureau reporter Chuck Quernbach is going to be there. Hey, we're all going to be there because it's going to be a lot of fun. There's going to be great food and music. Of course, the lovely greenery of the domes and a lot of fun with WPR staff and listeners. The deadline is tomorrow, so you don't have any time. So go to www.wpr.org/Larry Mueller, and that's M-E-I-L-L-E-R, to get more information. But you got to do it today. Today is better. Tomorrow is the last chance. Okay? Scott Franklin, our guest. Scott, we have a caller, Patricia from Dousman. So let's go there. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. I have a question that's kind of strange. I always do our income taxes myself, but I never do them on the internet online. I always hand do them. And all of a sudden this year, we itemize and everything, but all of a sudden this year we had some stock that my husband, we inherited from his mother like 25 years ago. It's Nicor, a gas company. Someone else took them over. We didn't know they were doing it even, and merged, and then we all of a sudden have a capital gain. I don't know how to do it. I got the form like a 8949 or something, and a Schedule D it says you have to have, but I can't understand any of it. But my question is, can a person get the Internal Revenue Service on the phone, and will they go through it and go through it with you to fill it out? Or can you, like, start filling one out on the internet at the free tax thing and then just quit once you've got the part filled in you don't know how to do, and then do it by hand? Can you do that? I can't find an accountant that will do just that for me and hand it back to me. And I don't blame them because, you know, they can't be responsible if I do everything else wrong.
Right. So. Typically, first off, if it's inherited property, the capital gain or loss is based on the date of death value when the stock was inherited.
I've got all that. I got that all information, the cost basis. I have it all, but I can't understand any of them instructions on how to fill out the dumb form 8949 or whatever it is and the Schedule D.
And I can tell you many tax preparers feel the same way. essentially what happened is the Schedule D has been the way you reported capital gains and losses for the last zillion years. And starting in 2011, the IRS wants stock brokerage firms, mutual fund companies, et cetera, to start reporting to the IRS cost basis of stocks, mutual funds, bonds sold. And it's phasing in so that the rules started in 2011. We're only reporting stuff that was bought and then sold in 2011 and expands into the future. So instead of just using the Schedule D to report your gains and losses, what you paid for, what the basis, what the selling price is to come up with gains or losses, the 8949 form is now the detailed schedule that used to be part of the Schedule D itself. So somebody who has a long-term capital gain that would be which inherited property would be filling out a Form 8949 for long-term gains, and then they would be indicating either a box A, B, or C, and if the stock was sold and reported on a 1099-B from the stock company to you, you would be filling out an 8949 with box B checked. You would use that form to show the details of the stock that is being reported, and then the 8949 gets summarized and transferred over to Schedule D to do the capital gain and loss tallies, the tax calculation, and so forth. It's a lot more work.
So my mind is exploding.
My brains are
exploding.
It's a lot more work for all of us tax preparers, and the big brokerage firms are not having a fun time with it either. My recommendation would be to go to the IRS.gov website, and they do allow you to e-file for free off the IRS through the IRS website. I am not positive if you could do the whole return, print it off, and then just not go through with the e-filing and then submit it through the postal system.
You could phone, though, and get somebody from IRS online, and I think, can't you, Scott, to sort of walk you through at least that portion of it?
I am not sure that would necessarily be the best idea. The main phone number for taxpayer assistance at the IRS is 1-800-829-1040. They will give you answers to common information. I don't know that they would necessarily walk a taxpayer through the form.
Okay, so...
Okay.
There you go. But you might have to break down this year and get somebody to help you out.
I might have to. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. At least 1 year, have somebody else do it and see how it goes. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We're talking with Scott Franklin today about your taxes, so you better join in. It's about your taxes. Nora and Phillips, your turn. Hi, Nora.
Hi. I have a question on homestead credit.
Sure.
I moved to Wisconsin last year, and I started renting in April 1st. And so this April, it'll be a year. But I was told you had to live here a year, you had to rent for a year. But then does that include 1911, too? I mean, 1912? Actually, it'd only be from 9 months from last year.
The homestead credit form is done on a calendar year basis, and it does require you to be a resident of Wisconsin for the entire year. So if you moved during mid-2011, you would not be eligible for it for 2011, but assuming you're here for the entire 2012, then you would be able to claim it on next year's tax filing.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Actually, another caller from Wausau wondered if that homestead credit had been eliminated because she couldn't find any information on it.
No, it is still there. The schedule is Wisconsin Schedule H for the homestead credit, and it is pretty much in the same format that it's been for the last many years.
Okay. And we have more callers online, so let's go to take some calls. But before I do that, you were really kind enough to do some research. Dale, another person, had some questions given on the program last month when we talked about taxes that Dale wasn't able to answer. So Dale researched those questions after the tax show last month, and Judith just posted those on the Facebook page. So there's a couple of questions there. If you ask those questions and Dale said she'd get back to you, why, go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you'll find those questions and answers. So we got that there going. Ted Minocqua. Hello.
Yeah, how you doing today?
Good.
I'm going to put in a good word for all the accountants and everything out there that when I had my own business, I had an accountant, and I don't think it ever cost me more than about $125. And now that I'm kind of older and everything, we just did our taxes, and it was like $73. I mean, you can't go wrong. I'm just putting in a good word for you. I don't know what the rates are all over, but for what I pay and what I get, I couldn't be happier. So it's a lot simpler than pulling my hair out.
Yeah. Very good.
Deb, thank you very much for calling. You know, and Scott, I think that's very true.
Yes, it is.
You're not going to argue with that one. Thanks, Dad.
Yep, you bet, Dad.
Yeah, appreciate it. Eric in Eagle, Wisconsin. It's your turn. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have a question here. My father passed away, and I'm trustee for we have a irrevocable family trust.
Okay.
And my daughter became half the beneficiary of the trust, and now we're selling the building. The problem becomes this way. What do I use for my daughter's basis? Is it the thing we did at the time my father passed away?
If the property...
The value? Yeah.
Yeah, if the property was owned by a revocable trust...
Yeah.
...that was... And the trust itself was owned by a person who died, then you would use the date of death value on the calculation of gain and loss of that building. If the property was put into the trust and it really had nothing to do with the person who passed away, then the value of the property would be whatever the original purchase price of it was. So there would have to be probably a quick analysis or reading of the trust document just to make sure. But a typical revocable trust is put in by a person, and then when that person dies, everything in the trust would get a step up in basis to date of death.
Yeah, the problem we have is that my mother's still alive, and she's the other member, went from an irrevocable trust to to another kind of trust. And the question I have is, because the value was like $100,000 more than the other thing, so does my daughter take a loss and my mother pays from the basis?
Well, this might be a little too complicated to go over on the radio, but in Wisconsin's marital property law, if husband and wife are the co-owners of a revocable trust, the property in the trust would get a step up no matter who dies first. So husband dies, wife dies, whatever's in the trust that they jointly owned would get a step up in basis for all of it.
Okay.
As I'm listening to your scenario, it probably would require somebody to just do a quick read of the trust document and see how the asset is owned and how the distributions are going to the beneficiaries.
And then one other quick question. If they wanted to buy another property outside of Wisconsin, could they make that a trade deal, like a Starker?
Yes, the Starker trades, also known as a 1031 exchange,
is
when you would take property that you want and trade it for property that you have but don't want anymore. You have to use specialized brokers so that the tax code requirements are met. And if it's going to stay within the trust, you may or may not have to do something special in the other state regarding just registering
called,
the trust.
When I called Wisconsin Internal Revenue Service, they told me that I couldn't buy a piece of property outside of Wisconsin. Is that the case?
You mean trade?
Yeah, the trade outside of Wisconsin.
I am not aware of any tax code restrictions. A 1031 Starker exchange is a provision under federal tax law, and it would cross state lines without a
problem. There you go. Good luck, Eric. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Cuba City, it's on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question was, I live in Wisconsin, but I work in Iowa. And on the Iowa form, it says that my Iowa state return from last year is not taxable as Iowa income. But when I fill out the non-resident form, it wants me to use numbers off of my federal tax return. And then I don't know how to claim it was like $800 and some that was an Iowa state return, but I'm not sure how I put that down because they want me to list Iowa source income in one column and other income in the other column. And I'm a little confused on how to list that Iowa state return from last year.
All right. Typically, a Wisconsin resident who works in another state would be filing a Wisconsin tax return where you list all income earned wherever you earned it, be it Wisconsin or
Iowa
or Michigan. There are some compacts with some of the neighboring states, most notably Illinois, on the Wisconsin tax return, and I'm just double-checking that right now. With reciprocity rules, a Wisconsin resident can work in Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, or Michigan and not have to worry about filing a tax return in that other state. For Iowa, we don't have reciprocity, so you would be doing an Iowa non-resident tax return. The typical way these forms work all the states is you would have one column that essentially shows all of your federal taxable income off of your U.S. tax return, and then the second column would show just the income taxable to Iowa, which in your case would be your wage income. The tax form then determines what your income tax liability is to the state of Iowa. That tax paid to Iowa is taken as a deduction on your Wisconsin tax return, so you are not double taxed on that same income. But you do file a return in Iowa.
Yeah, I understand. I'm trying to file because I need to put the copy of the Iowa return with my Wisconsin return.
Exactly.
My federal, but that's where I'm confused. On the Iowa, the actual Iowa form, it specifically states that an Iowa state tax refund is not considered income. But when I go to the non-resident form for the same line, it says to use the number off the federal form, which includes my Iowa income. And then it just says Iowa source income only and then other sources. And I'm not sure if I don't include the $800 refund from last year, then my numbers don't jive quite right.
My guess is that the Iowa tax form, even the non-resident form, does not want you to add back the Iowa tax refund because in all the states, the state refund is generally not taxable to the state it was issued by.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Tom.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it. We have a Facebook question from Sue who says, my son is raising his wife's son, who is 3. He gets benefits from the Army, also Social Security, because his father is deceased. And we're talking about the wife's son.
Sounds like a stepchild situation.
Yeah. Can the son still take a deduction, or can my son still take a deduction for the young son, for him, and do they need to include his benefits for tax purposes?
I'm assuming that the son, that the adult son and the wife are filing a joint tax return. And so on the joint tax return, they would be able to take a dependency exemption for the child of, it sounds like, a deceased parent.
Yep.
The Social Security benefits received in the child's name would be technically reportable on the child's tax return. However, if that's the only income the child received, it's going to be tax-free, and no tax report would actually have to be submitted.
There you go. We have more callers. By the way, open lines, you can join in at 1-800 800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll get you on pretty quick. Pat in La Crosse, you're next. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have a question. What happens if you get audited and you can't, my wife and I own a rental business, and you cannot produce the slips because with today's modern technology, the laser printing, over a course of a year, the ink actually disappears on white paper. We open up the envelopes, and we've got 300 and some blank pieces of white paper.
Oh.
What kind of slips do you, like 1099s or?
Gas slip, receipts.
Oh, receipts. Typically, if you had an audit, they would want to see your receipts. If they are credit card receipts, they would try and match them up to the credit card bills. If you have any other kind of documentation to store with it, I would say you hang on to that.
Okay.
If there was an audit at the point that you're saying these are the slips, they're very hard to read, as long as it looks like you have the documentation there, you're probably going to be okay. I would certainly save the invisible slips, the slips with invisible ink. I wouldn't throw them out just because the ink has faded.
Yeah.
Okay. We were going back trying to figure some past things out, and we opened up the envelopes, and it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah. I had the same issue this year on a couple of them, and they would have been deductions, but I could not see what they were. They were completely gone, so obviously I couldn't put them in as deductions because I didn't know what they were even. You know, it was something from sometime during the year.
Yep.
And so now what I do is writing on the bottom of the slip when it comes in ink.
Well, and it's, people think you're crazy when you tell them this, but honest to God.
Yeah, well, no.
Either do that or scan it and keep it on computer.
Yeah, that's a good way, especially for a business.
And have online access that gives you access to records for 3 or 4 years. A lot of the banking websites now don't give you canceled checks anymore back in the mail, so you have to go online if the IRS would ever want to see a canceled check. So the audit processes are catching up with technology, although technology is still ahead of the IRS, I think most people would agree.
Scott Franklin, our guest, certified public accountant, works with Kohler and Franklin, certified public accountants out of Milwaukee. Great to have him along. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mueller Show. Thursday, April 5th, I'll be hosting the second annual WPR Listener Dinner. Wanted to mention that again. It'll be at the Milwaukee Mitchell Park Domes. We'll be doing a mock garden talk show with Melinda Myers. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I've been asked to mention this more than once because the deadline for registering is tomorrow. So get that in. Go to WPR.org/Larry Mueller for more information on registering for it. Great food and music, chance to meet a whole bunch of people from WPR, and some great listeners as well. Jan in Elkhorn. On to you now. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I just wondered, I have a question because my mother has been a widow for 8 years, and her income is only like $800 in Social Security, so she's never filed taxes. And now she lives in assisted living and gets $1,000 a month from the veterans as a benefit to pay towards her $3,000 a month charge.
Okay.
Does she have to file a tax return now or pay any taxes on that veteran's benefit?
Is the veteran's benefit a long-term care insurance policy, or is
It's to help pay for her needs in the assisted living. It's not a nursing home.
If the money that she's receiving is
only because she's in assisted living and this is to help cover her long-term care costs, my initial reaction would be that it is insurance money that she's receiving that offsets the veterans' expense of the long-term care facility. That would mean it would not necessarily be taxable. I could see a situation where somebody would say it is reportable as income, and then you file a tax return and say you've got $1,000 of income, but you have a deduction for long-term care costs that more than offsets the income. My feeling would be, though, that it is a insurance-type benefit that she's getting from the VA, and unless the VA is issuing a 1099 that says otherwise, I would treat it as non-taxable and not require a tax return.
So if you don't get a 1099...
No, I didn't get a 1099 on it, and so I don't have to start filing a tax report for her?
No, I would be pretty comfortable with saying not at this point, just based on the way you've described it as money that they started paying once she moved into the facility.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Vicki in Madison, hi to you.
Hello there. My question is about the IRS definition of a repair and their definition of an improvement. I own my own business, and I own the building in which it's located as well. And so this has always puzzled me, but especially in 2011, I did $42,000 worth, Ike, yes, really, of repairs to the building. It was the foundation was crumbling, floor joists, the whole nightmare. So I have that for 2011, $42,000 in repairs, and then also what I would call improvements where it was more new construction, and $5,000 in improvements. So those are my two questions.
Well, I think the issue you have to look at is, are you prolonging or maintaining the useful life of the asset, the building, or are you doing improvements? And it also would depend on if you're talking about a one-story rental versus a 20-story office building, where an office building could easily have $50,000 of repairs during a year, but $50,000 of something on a smaller building might constitute a capital expenditure. My thought would be that if it is the repair of crumbling foundation and you're not really doing anything other than retarding the damage and stabilizing it so that the building continues to live out the rest of its useful life, I would probably be comfortable calling that a repair expense versus a capitalized expenditure.
And then improvements would always be capitalized.
Correct. And if it is a long-term enough improvement, it could be 27.5-year depreciation period or 39-year, depending on what kind of property we're talking about. The rules for repair versus maintenance are somewhat subjective depending on the facts of the particular instance, but I would not personally have a problem calling foundation repairs a repair, even if it was an expensive repair.
Deal. Yep.
And then that, if that caused me to, on my personal return, to show, that I lost money, I would be able to carry that forward then?
Correct, because now it's going to flow through on a Schedule E, and depending on how much other income you have, a rental loss will not necessarily be fully deductible anyway on your personal return, and it would get carried into the future.
Okay, well, thank you. Great answer. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And Ellen in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I've got a question on 401k disbursement. I recently moved this last summer from Florida, and I had a loan against my 401k. So when I changed employer, or when I moved to Wisconsin, you know, I had to pay off that balance. So they took it as a disbursement. Do I need to claim that in Wisconsin as income, even though it wasn't earned in Wisconsin?
The, I guess the timing of when the transaction was would be the determining factor. If you moved to Wisconsin as of, let's just say, September 1st, and the distribution out of the 401k to pay off the loan was on September 15th, I think you would be hard-pressed to say that it is not taxable in Wisconsin. If it happened that you left your employer on August 1st, they took the money out on August 15th, and then you moved to Wisconsin, you probably have a good argument to say that that income and distribution is not taxable to Wisconsin, and because Florida doesn't have a state income tax, it would not be taxable except on the federal tax return. So I do think you need to look at the timing of when the transaction happened in relationship to when you lived in moved to Wisconsin.
Okay, so if I was in Wisconsin at the time of disbursement, it would be considered income in Wisconsin.
Yes.
So I'd have to claim it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to Terry in Richland Center. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I am an adult family home provider. I have three adult family homes. Two of them are state licensed. One of them is my primary residence, and it's county certified. And I'd like to know if my residents qualify for, like, the homestead exemption or the any type of a tax rebate for the room that they pay. They pay room and board, and then there's also residential services.
The homestead credit would be based on property taxes that you paid on your house. It would be limited, however, to lower income claimants. So if your income is in a ballpark of $25,000 or more, you would not qualify for the homestead credit. My thought would be if you are renting out rooms in your house in a for-profit venture, you may be able to take some depreciation expenses and some deductions related to the rental use of the house. Again,
yeah, this is basically what I'm asking for the clients themselves.
If the clients are living in your house and they're paying rent, and
it's not actually rent, it's a room and board rate that's set, and then there's the residential services, so it's out of the room and board rate, the amount of rent that they pay, or not rent, but what they pay for board. If I have those numbers, could I submit those for them, you know, get those for them, and then they could file for the homestead exemption?
If you are a landlord and you provide them with a rent certificate documenting how much money they are paying towards rent, they probably would be able to claim the homestead credit on the amount of money that they're paying.
Okay.
You would have to look at some special rules for rent certificates issued by community-based residential facilities or nursing homes or long-term care facilities. It's not as easy as just saying that they're paying $500 a month in rent and taking a rent certificate for that.
Yeah.
But if you do meet the criteria to issue a rent certificate, they should be able to claim homestead credit based on the rent paid.
There you go.
It would be based on the board portion or the room portion of what they pay out of their Social Security.
Correct.
Yep. There you go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Jim. Jim, are you there? I guess we lost Jim. Well, that's too bad. I thought he was there, but I guess he's not. Are there things that a self-employed person, just here in the last minute before we go to our break, things a self-employed person can deduct that other folks can't?
Yeah, typically a self-employed individual can really deduct any legitimate business expense, no different than any other corporation or partnership type business. The things to remember are meals and entertainment. You can only deduct half of that. If somebody has a home office, they may be able to take a deduction for the home office expense. In this new modern world of cable-based telephones or internet telephones, you can deduct your business use of these phones, but the residential portion of the first incoming telephone line into a house is not deductible. Health insurance expense is essentially fully deductible on a tax return for a self-employed person, whereas if they were paying health insurance but not self-employed, it's only an itemized deduction, and the first 7.5% of your income is worth of health insurance is not deductible, so there's benefits that way.
So lots to talk about with Scott Franklin. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Tax day coming up very quickly, more fast than we'd like to think of. And chances are you have some questions about how to file correctly. We're happy to have CPA and tax specialist Scott Franklin with us until 12:30. He has a lot of great advice and tips, and he's happy to answer your questions as well. So if you're wondering how life changes like a new job or getting married or buying a home might affect your taxes, for the better or worse, or you want to decrease your taxable income, all kinds of questions like that Scott can handle for sure. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. And if you like it while you're there, click like. We'll send you daily updates on show topics. Back right after the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking today with Scott Franklin, certified public accountant. He's a lifelong resident of Milwaukee, joined Kohler and Franklin Certified Public Accountants in 1995. He's a CPA, plus he also has a law degree. Very experienced guy when it comes to taxes, and great to have him along. If you have a question for him, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234 or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And we do have a Facebook question, Scott, from Katie, who says, I'm a contracted delivery driver. Would you have any suggestions for deductions that a self-employed individual like myself might not think of?
Typically, I would say that if you're a delivery driver, you're probably going to have all the usual auto expense for gas, oil, insurance, all that fun stuff that goes into driving a car, parking fees, etc. The trick is, and if this is a full-time business, you're probably going to do better off taking deductions for actual expenses. You'd be depreciating the car if you're driving a personal car. You'd be able to pretty much, as I've mentioned before the break, write off all the legitimate business expenses. In terms of delivery driver specific, I don't know that there's anything that I would recommend that is a aha kind of expense, but I would tell her just make sure she keeps a mileage log or an odometer log of how many miles are being driven in a day, in a week, in a month, etc., so that when it comes time to do the tax return, she's able to properly decide if she should be using actual expenses or if she's qualified to take the IRS standard mileage rate. And again, it depends on what kind of vehicle she's driving. Is this a full-time enterprise, etc.?
Okay. Justin in Port Washington, it's your turn. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Hey, I'm looking at my property tax bill that I just received in January. It's paid directly by my mortgage company. The payment is dated as received by the county January 3rd of this year, but there's a note on the receipt that says that it was shipped on December 30th, 2011. Can I deduct this payment on my 2011 taxes?
Is the fact that it is dated January 3rd of 2011 because it was received on Tuesday the 3rd, or if it was in fact mailed in December, Tuesday, January 3rd may have been the first business day for the municipality? I would not have a problem taking that as a deduction in December if it was in fact paid and put into the mail in December, even though it wasn't receipted until January.
Okay.
There you go.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks. Done it myself a few years ago. I did that. I can't remember which year now, but it was a few years back, and it was fine. Linda in Luxembourg, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hello. Hi, Larry. I have a question about, well, what happened was I rolled over from a traditional Roth, no, from a traditional IRA into a Roth IRA, an amount of money last August.
Okay.
And at this time, I find that I put myself into a higher tax bracket.
Yep.
And that the investments are worth less than what they were when I rolled them over. So I've read about recharacterization, and I wonder if I should do that, how I do it. Or should I do a partial recharacterization?
Scott, what do you think?
Well, it does depend on what the rationale was for doing the Roth conversion in the first place. IRA accounts, as I'm sure everyone is aware, are tax-deferred accounts. You put money in, you get a tax deduction. You don't pay any tax until the money comes out at retirement. A Roth IRA is kind of the a non-deducted going in retirement plan. The money grows tax-free forever, and when you take the money out, again, you still do not pay taxes on it down the road. A Roth conversion is taking money from a traditional IRA and moving it into a Roth IRA. The downside is that you have to pay income taxes on the amount of money that you converted from regular to Roth. The upside is after you get done paying the taxes today, the money is now in a Roth IRA and again grows tax-free forever. What it sounds like is happening is now that the listener has to report that income on her tax return, she's seeing that the amount of income generated by the rollover has caused her to pay a lot of additional income taxes. In terms of doing a recharacterization, she could do that and undo what she's done, and that would have to be done by April 17th this year. She can work with the IRA company to talk about the logistics of doing a recharacterization or unringing the bell, so to speak.
Yeah.
The problem would be what thought process went into the conversion in the first place, and does it still make sense to do that conversion even if you're going to pay some additional taxes on it now?
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Linda. Appreciate your call very much. Mary in Danbury, hello to you.
Hello. My question is, if someone is the recipient of the payable on death benefits from a certificate of deposit, and this person is a non-relative of the deceased, how is that taxed?
From an income tax perspective, whoever essentially inherits the balance in a POD account is going to take it income tax free for the value of that inheritance. there may be some interest income that might have a little bit of tax consequence, but there's not going to be an income tax on the inheritance, and I would assume there's not going to be any worries about a federal or Wisconsin estate tax or death tax. So the general rule would be it's tax-free.
Even for a non-relative?
Correct. Anybody can inherit money from anyone, and it's not going to cause an income tax problem.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Patricia in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I set up an irrevocable trust for my daughter back in 2009, and it cost me about $1,800 in lawyer fees. That year, I took that as a deduction off of what she made on the trust, and there ended up being a $1,400 loss because it's not a large amount. And the following year, in 2010, I did not carry that over. Now, I'm wondering, in 2011, my daughter died, and I'm doing her final estate, and I'm wondering if I can go back and amend the 2010 returns and use that loss, or does that loss just get lost?
An operating loss in a trust is typically not going to be deductible against carrying out if there was an excess loss. But if the 2010 trust tax return had income and you issued a K-1, Schedule K-1 to your daughter for trust distributions, if there were some administrative expenses that could have been deducted but weren't, you probably should do an amended tax return for the trust for 2010 to correct the Schedule K-1. That might give a lower amount of income that would be passed through to your daughter. And then you'd have to amend the personal tax return for 2010 as well in order to get back any tax overpayment made because of this. So depending on how the math works out, it may definitely be worth your effort to amend the 2010 trust return for the deductions that weren't taken.
Yeah.
Well, the only deduction there really was setting it up for the lawyer. That initial year in 2009. So if I can't carry that forward, then there were no other expenses to the trust.
Okay, then I would say if it was deducted in 2009, any excess loss over and above the 2009 income would not be deductible.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm sorry for your loss of your daughter.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. It's a hard thing to lose a daughter. Eric in Hudson, it's your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
I have a quick question about charitable contributions or donations. We have just a large amount of clothing and furniture and things like that that we've thought about selling, either an auction site or in the newspaper or whatever, but there's such an abundance of it, I've thought, well, maybe it would be best just to drop this off at a Goodwill or someplace like that and take a deduction on our taxes. What is the best way to account for that if you are going to donate it? And then what is the percentage, if you don't get the full value of it, what is the percentage that I can expect to actually get deducted?
Well, a charitable donation of non-cash items, household stuff, et cetera, going to Goodwill or Salvation Army type of organization has to be in what is called good use condition. So the IRS no longer will allow you to donate your ripped jeans and take a deduction as if they were brand new. In order to really have an airtight, ironclad deduction, not only do you want to make sure you get the thank you slip from the charity when they pick it up or when you drop it off, you really should have an itemized listing of what you're giving and how you're coming up with a value. I have some clients that use a I believe it's a TurboTax sponsored website called It's Deductible. It's a free service off of the internet where you put in what you've donated, check the boxes, you know, like blue jeans or shoes, tennis shoes, white, and it gives you a valuation of that. And then that's what they give me is this printout, and we take that on the tax return. Keep in mind that any non-cash donation over $500, there is an additional form that has to be attached to your Schedule A. It's a form 8283 for non-cash donations. If you think you're going to be claiming a deduction of $5,000 or more, you might actually want you will be required to get a appraisal where an expert comes in and actually gives you a valuation report for the items you're donating. But if it's under $5,000, you really just need to have a really good itemized list of what you're giving and some reasonable basis for how you've come up with the numbers you're putting down.
My wife and I have to go through this every year because we donate a lot of clothing, and so literally you're writing down five women's blouses, four pairs of children's shoes or whatnot, and we've used TurboTax after the fact to then get a cost or a value for it. So it's a fair amount of work, but it's really the only way to do it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And is the value that you're putting down on this form 8283, is that the full value then is taken off from your taxes?
What you're doing is you're coming up with the fair market value at the time you make the donation. And assuming you take itemized deductions on your tax return, it reduces your income dollar for dollar by the amount of money that you're claiming for the value of the charitable gift as part of the total amount of itemized deductions shown on your return.
So it can amount to a lot of money.
It can, and if you're in a 25% marginal tax bracket, if you have itemized deductions and then you add $1,000 of donations, that's a $250 savings on the tax return.
Right. Okay. Perfect. That's exactly what I was looking for.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Takes a little work, but it can be worth it. Peter in Cascade, Iowa. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question in regards to if I retired from civil service after some 30-some years, and part of the severance was also to pay half of my health insurance. If I started up a painting business or a business of sorts, self-employed, and only generated $10,000 to $15,000 of income from that self-employment, can I deduct the other half of health insurance that I have to pay? As long as I'm working gainfully.
Yes, if your pension is paying half the insurance and you're paying the other half in what we call after tax dollars, you are able to take a deduction for that insurance money. Insurance expense against self-employment income, and as long as you have some amount of self-employment income, the health insurance would be a dollar-for-dollar deduction pretty much up to the amount of self-employed income that you would be generating.
If my income was lower than, let's say, my cost for insurance is $4,000 a year and I only generate $3,000 of painting business, how would that affect that situation?
You would typically be allowed to take a self-employed health insurance deduction for the health insurance expense up to the amount of business income, and then let's say $3,000, you'd have about a $3,000 deduction for self-employed health insurance on the front page of your tax return. The remaining $1,000 would go on to your Schedule A itemized deductions for medical expenses, and depending on the rest of your tax return, that may or may not be a deductible amount.
Thank you much.
Yep, thanks much for calling. And Jane in Appleton, on to you now. Hi, Jane.
Hi there. I had a question here. My daughter graduated UW-Madison in 2010. It's a job in New York, 2011, and she just got laid off from her job in February. Now, I'm just wondering, is there a cap on her earnings where I could claim her for a dependent again if she goes to school in fall of 2012 or spring of 2013? And then the second part of that would be I would be adding her onto my insurance, and I wondered about imputed income from adding her to my insurance, because in Wisconsin we can cover them until they're 26, I believe.
Okay. Well, let the second question first. I actually just looked that up this morning. Back in December, the Wisconsin legislature and Governor Walker did sign into law a conformity of Wisconsin law to federal law. So basically, if you have an adult child under age 27, health insurance that you get through your employer is not considered imputable income. So that your employer can add a 26-year-old child to your family plan, and you don't have to pay any taxes for it. Obviously, the employer might charge you or adjust your pay, but at least there's no income tax consequence.
Okay.
As far as the claiming her as a dependency exemption, if she is older than 24 when she is in school, the only way you would be able to claim her as an exemption is if her income is under $3,800 for the full year. So, obviously, for 2011, if she was living in New York and working full-time, 2011 is not part of the equation.
No.
But for 2012, if she was a full-time student under age 24, which I don't think the math would work out, there wouldn't be an income problem.
Yep.
If she's older than 24, her income has to be under
$3,900. And a third part to that is I notice that I get imputed taxable income on my term life insurance. How can
yes.
that be? And I have to take this out there because I need to travel again.
Okay. Anybody who gets group term life insurance through their employer, the employer is required to impute income on the premiums paid for in excess of $50,000 of coverage. So tax code says the first $50,000 is a tax-free fringe benefit. The insurance to provide more than $50,000 of coverage is imputed as income under longstanding tax rules.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Brian, do you have a quick question in Appleton? Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if you use your car for work and you got a loan on it, is some of
interest?
The interest, yeah. Is this some of that deductible or is it used for work?
It goes back to, I think, what we were talking about with one of the earlier callers. It depends how much of the car is being used for business versus personal use. If you are taking the standard mileage rate, that includes the cost of acquiring the car, paying interest on it, or making payments on a car lease. If you're using actual expenses, the interest on a loan would be deductible. It again depends on the math and what business portion the car is and what's the most advantageous way to crunch the numbers.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Scott, thank you so much. A great hour and a half. I hope you'll come back and be with us again at some point.
It's fun. I'd do this again, sure.
All right. Scott Franklin, certified public accountant, a lifelong resident of Milwaukee. He's an accountant. He's also a lawyer. He had a law degree. He joined Kohler and Franklin, certified public accountants in Milwaukee in 1995. And he's our guest, and we'll probably have him back and do it again with him. Just a quick reminder, again, that Thursday, April 5th, I'll be hosting the second annual WPR Listener Dinner at Milwaukee's Mitchell Park Domes. Lots of fun. Melinda Myers is going to be with us. And our hosts, Kathleen Dunn and Ben Marins and Chuck Quernbach, are all going to be there. Melinda and I are going to do kind of a garden talk. You'll be able to ask her questions and ask me questions and probably ask questions of Kathleen and Ben and everybody else, so, and other listeners. So go to WPR.org/LarryMeeler for information. The deadline is tomorrow, so you got to do it. Thanks for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.